Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Dishing with Digest. I'm Stephanie Sloan, editorial director, here with Mara Levinsky, senior editor.
Hi, everyone.
Well, Mara, lots of news brewing across the soap dial. Greg Vaughn, who has played Daze's Eric Brady since 2012, revealed on Steve Burton and Bradford Anderson's podcast, That's Awesome, that he has left the show. So Greg says he's taking a break, not necessarily saying goodbye altogether, but adds that he was filming episodes of OWN's Queen Sugar, a show I absolutely love, before the pandemic hit. So I guess we will see how the show is going to wrap up Eric's story. Now, this announcement comes on the heels of Christian Alfonso's that she is leaving as well. We have an in-depth interview with Christian in our new issue. She told me she had actually thought about leaving 4 years ago, but stayed at executive producer Ken Corday's behest, and shares what was behind her thinking and how she feels now that she's made her decision to go.
That was a very emotional interview. I mean, I got choked up reading it. You know, in daytime, we have a tendency to say never, because there are countless examples of actors, you know, saying they're never coming back and changing their minds. But there was a finality to Christian's tone that I was really struck by. Mm-hmm. But regardless of what happens in the future, you know, the mark she has left on Days is indisputable. And it's a bummer, too, to be saying goodbye to Greg Vaughn, especially since Eric and Nicole have finally found their long-awaited happiness. You know, I'm already bracing myself for what drama might befall them to usher Eric off the canvas. Now, those are the headline exits. And in terms of returns, fans are, of course, awaiting the hotly anticipated returns of original episodes of Y&R and GH. The good news there is that both shows are well on their way to returning to the airwaves. GH has confirmed that its triumphant return will take place on Monday, August 3rd, and I think fans can expect a formal announcement of Y&R's return date in the very near future as well.
Which is great news. One show that is back is Bold and Beautiful, and I cannot express how absolutely thrilled I was to watch new episodes and see the actors. I mean, it was a total, like, hello, old friends moment. You know, and interestingly, the episode that they came back with was a new episode, but then the two episodes after that had actually been filmed before the pandemic. And the show held those episodes because Wyatt walking into the beach house with such a surprised look on his face, you know, really turned out to be like the most perfect cliffhanger.
Yeah.
But now we're really going to get to see how they're filming under the new guidelines and what the show is going to look like. I mean, you can see in the scenes that people are, you know, maybe a little further apart than you would expect, but it doesn't feel like strange. Mm-hmm. I also love how during that conversation between Carter and Katie, they made a veiled reference to the pandemic in terms of like that they've been away a while. They had that Bold is Back messaging video, but they were actually talking about the reopening of the Forrester boutique. So it was like clever without hitting you over the head with, you know, COVID.
Right, totally. And, you know, and my goodness, like they aired a doozy of a preview teasing some of the major storyline twists that the show is going to be serving up in the coming weeks. My hat is off to B&B for returning to the airwaves with a bang and creating, I think, a good deal of positive buzz and fan excitement, both over the innovative ways that they've come up with to sort of fudge intimacy, if you will, given that the actors are practicing social distancing on the set, and also giving a real story payoff. So, I mean, like, that's how you do it.
Yep.
That's how you come back successfully when a daytime show is forced to do something that a daytime show is not meant to do, which is go on a long hiatus. I feel like B&B really got the memo on, you know, sucking fans back in right off the bat.
Oh, Totally. And, you know, it's very interesting because with the classic episodes, you know, two former colleagues of ours told me that they've been watching old soaps on YouTube while quarantining because like the classic episodes sort of set the tone. And they told me that it brings a big sense of comfort to them, like seeing like real classic episodes. Like, I don't know if you caught the Young and Restless first two episodes, like that was mind blowing.
It's so
like,
cool to
watch those.
Yeah, absolutely.
But one of our old friends has been watching Another World, the other All My Children. And actually more specifically, she said Tad and Dixie because she loved them. They were her favorite couple. And, you know, they certainly were one of the show's signature couples. And I know they hold a very special place in so many viewers' hearts.
Mine included. You know, I think the very first episode of All My Children I ever saw was Tad and Dixie's first wedding in December 1989. And that show ultimately became a big part of my life, not just from a fan perspective, but because it was the show I covered for Soap Opera Digest from 2002 through 2011 when it was canceled. And Tad and Dixie certainly had their ups and downs, as any good long-running soap couple would. And while their three marriages to one another doesn't set a daytime record, they do have the distinction of being the only couple where both members of the pairing donned a chicken suit as a romantic gesture. But I think they were one of that show's best examples of an against all odds kind of couple, which is like catnip soap fans.
Absolutely. Well, our guest today is Katie McLean, who played Dixie, as well as the World Turns' Rosanna and Young and Restless' Kelly. So let's check in with her and see what's going on. Hi, Katie.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
We're doing well. We're so happy you could join us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, first of all, tell us how you've been doing the past few months.
Well, it's been interesting, hasn't it? It's been interesting. You know, at first, I think I was terrified and really upset. And then I just kind of realized that it was really, that attitude was everything and that I was going to have to really do things that gave me joy and focus on positive things that I could have control over. So, and I also thought about the fans a lot, and I started posting, you know, just live from our kitchen. We were cooking dinner or singing a song or something that was letting people in a little bit more, because I think I thought immediately a lot of other people must be very afraid. And there must also be people out there who, you know, are having to look at quarantining by themselves. And, you know, I always have a soft spot in my heart for people who suffer with loneliness. So I got very busy doing those things for a while. And that also kind of gave me a purpose and a focus for a while. Then, of course, the whole world decided to do the same thing. And we had Lady Gaga and like thousands of people singing on television. And I was like, okay, I think everybody's going to be good for a while. I'm going to go pick some bread.
So you, as you know, made your entree into showbiz at a remarkably young age. You were working on stage and in TV commercials starting at the age of 9. And then it was just about 10 years after that, in 1988, when you were tapped to play the role of Dixie Cooney on All My Children. So to kick us off, tell us your All My Children casting story.
Let's see. I was 18 when I auditioned for All My Children, and they wanted me to screen test the first time around. And I had been cast in a pilot with Michael McKean. And so I couldn't, because that the pilot, we were waiting to find out if the pilot was going to go. It wasn't picked up and it became a TV movie. So a few months later, when they were looking to recast, I was called back in for a screen test, and I was very excited about that for many reasons. You know, I'd auditioned for Loving and Guiding Light and really bombed those. Oh my God. I was so, I mean, for Guiding Light, I went into like, what do you call it? Like, I just blanked. Like the dust motes were floating in front of my eyes. Oh, wow. I could feel the sweat trickling down my back. And they were like, Katie, Katie. I like heard it as an echo in my head. I was like, what's happening? They're like, it's okay. It's okay. Next time. I mean, I couldn't remember a thing. I didn't know what was happening. I was so terrified. So I was like, you better get a grip, girl. And you need this job. You know, and everyone was very kind when I got there. You know, it was the old studio on 66th Street, and the from the casting director to the executive producer. David Canary was who I did the screen test. And I just didn't even look at any of the other girls. I just put up blinders. I was wearing a suede skirt with a silk shirt with shoulder pads.
Of course.
1988, of course.
Yeah, it was.
You know, and I just, man, I just used every ounce of effort that I had to keep focused, remember my lines, do what I said I was going to do. And, you know, thank goodness they liked it. You know, it was a big break, big break. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, it's sort of rare that a newcomer gets handed as heavy a storyline load as you got in those early years as Dixie. So by 1990, she had married Adam Chandler and born him a son, fallen in love with Tad and married him, which are all like huge plot developments. So there was not a gentle introduction to the pace of daytime, if you will. Was that exciting to you or was it overwhelming?
I had been a dancer as a kid, and so discipline and pushing yourself past pain was very normal for me. You know, I was a tap dancer in particular, and, you know, we would dance until our feet bled. And so, you know, then you'd put like a piece of moleskin. I don't know, you know what that is. It's like a, mm-hmm. it's like a thick cover that sticks onto your heel and, you know, and you just keep going until you just couldn't anymore. So, you know, grinding it out was in my blood. And frankly, I have to say I enjoyed that challenge and I still do. I still push myself to go further, work harder, do more than probably most people might enjoy. For me, I love the challenge. So in that regard, it wasn't overwhelming. I just felt the responsibility and I felt like I had to do well or else I wasn't an actor. I mean, I had to do really well. I'd been working since I was 9 and, you know, I was never like, even though I had great discipline, I never had that, I want to be famous thing. And I never had that, look at me, I'm a star, pay attention to me thing. That just never was my jam. So, but I knew I had to have something that pushed myself out of my shyness. And you know, in order to focus. And so in order to accomplish the challenge of all of these scenes, and thank goodness I'd started studying with a guy named Michael Howard and I had craft to fall back on. And so I just kept studying and doing my craft and doing, you know, things that people made fun of me for, like breathing exercises on set or stretching on set or, you know, bringing in extra props or photographs and hiding them on set so I could have more of a connection to the character. And that was my goal. If I didn't do really, really well on the show, then I wasn't meant to be an actor and I should do something else. So that's kind of how I talked myself into being able to face the heavy load. And, you know, I didn't have any concept of the impact that was having on people. All I did was, do I still have my job today? Great. Oh, I've got another scene. Great. Oh, I'm working more. Great. They're going to keep me. They're not going to fire me. Isn't that ridiculous? So, I mean, you kind of have to think that way in this business. It's really hard business and you are being judged every day. And if you don't give your best one day, you know, you have to be already very successful to be able to slack a little bit. Mm-hmm. You know, you earn your slacking.
Well, I don't even know how many non-working hours you had at that time, but I'm curious because you were a California girl and now you're living and working in Manhattan. You know, what kind of culture shock was that aspect of being on All My Children like for a young Katie McLean?
Well, I had moved there when I was 17 with a play and we did that at the John Drew out in East Hampton. And so I had almost 2 years in New York without having a big job. We lived in a studio apartment and, you know, me and my mom on a futon. But it was still great. You know, I went to dance classes all the time and I walked the streets and I wanted to move to New York. I had to move to New York. I had to get out of Los Angeles because what I realized then at 16 years old was that, you know, a girl my age was, I'll just say it. I mean, I was shark chum. you know, I was blood in the water, and I started noticing that people starting to touch me and be too close to me. And I, you know, I just knew I had to get out of Los Angeles or else I was going to get eaten alive. And also, you know, New York gave me freedom. We couldn't afford for me to get a driver's license. So I had to be able to get around without my mother because she was driving me bananas. So as every 16-year-old's mother does. So so New York, just when the play went to New York, I was like, oh, okay, here we go. This is what we need to do. I can train here. I can take classes. I can, you know, I can, you know, I feel safer. And here's the crazy thing, you know, what New York makes you face is it's just more direct. It's still there. It's just more direct. So, I mean, the construction workers, the, you know, it's just not subtle. And, that scared the hell out of me too. I mean, I had people following me. I mean, it was crazy. But I had to learn how to handle it. And, you know, New York was a good place to learn it.
Now, your first All My Children husband, as you mentioned, was played by the late legendary David Canary. Tell us what David was like and just what it was like to work with him.
Well, everybody wanted to work with David because David was always prepared. He was a professional. He had he was incredibly disciplined, incredibly structured. And in his day, you know, he always swam for an hour before he even came to work. And he didn't live in New York City. So it was quite a journey for him to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, swim for an hour, and then take an hour drive into the city. And, you know, he always had fruit for breakfast, salad for lunch. You know, you could count on him like clockwork, with a great attitude, never came in like a diva or divo. And, you know, was always listening to you, and, you know, he brought out the best. So if you were working with David Canary, you know, you were just like, oh, thank you, God. And he was a gentleman, and, you know, I mean, there was never any funny stuff or anything that made you feel creepy or weird. He was a total gentleman. So, I was so blessed to work with him and Julia Barr and Michael Knight, like right away, you know, they were, you know, the 5 gold star standard actors, I thought, on the show. And that's who I wanted to be with. So I did whatever I could to be with them. It's like, I will act my butt off. Just let me work with these people. So it was great. It was great.
Well, Tad and Dixie, of course, almost from the start, became fan favorites and became a super couple. What are your favorite memories of working with the man behind Tad, Michael E. Knight?
Boy, favorite memories. You know, there were times we would laugh. I mean, like to the pee your pants type of laughing, like on set, just hysterical. And I think those and also the hours, my God, the days, hours, probably months and years that we spent working on the material. And by that, I mean, you know, with all great respect to the writers, you know, we as a team were allowed to put our own spin on things, move the pacing around a little bit. And it's so funny because I talked to him about this recently on, I think it was on Entertainment Weekly, and it came up, and he said, I said, you know, Mike, I think you kind of taught me how to write. And he goes, oh, no, you taught me how to write. So it's funny. I was like, that's so nice of you to say. But basically, we worked together. We worked off of each other and together as a team. And I loved that, you know, pushing back and forth. This works. No, that doesn't work. No, that's funny. No, that's not funny. We got to preserve this moment. That's what we did. We were, and you know, in later years when we kind of were backed off of that with different producing teams. I don't think it was as good. You know, it's, you know, somebody once said to me, and I don't mean to, like, you know, blow myself up here, but, you know, they said the kindest thing, it was so meaningful to me. And they said, you know, we all know that you're not Dixie, but Dixie wouldn't have been the same without you. And I was just like, oh, you know, thank you for saying that. Thank you for recognizing that, you know, this wasn't a character that anybody could have played, that I brought something, I brought me to it. And although I am not her, I, you know, there were elements of my humor or my things that moved me, and, you know, and I just really appreciated that 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 has been recognized in the long run, you know, because sometimes you do feel like you're a voice shouting in the wilderness, jumping up and down going, why? Anybody hear me? And you know, and yet, and I guess they did. I guess they did. So that's incredibly important. Mm-hmm.
Well, what do you think it was about the Tad Dixie pairing that struck such a chord with the audience?
He was handsome, and she was normal. And he was kind of morally always about to cross the line in a way that he shouldn't. And she came from a super grounded, earthy background with a lot of family wisdom that she could call upon even when she made mistakes. And that kind of grounded homespun family values, I guess, if you will, gave something to him as this sort of wild, you know, man about town that he could never have kind of accessed otherwise. And so they were, I think in some way it was a woman's dream, like, oh, I'll get the wild guy and settle him down, you know? But, you know, it was a nice fantasy. It was a fantasy that worked with these two characters. Yeah.
Agreed. The cat, Tad the cat, no more after Dixie. So in 1990, you won your first Daytime Emmy, and the name of this category tickles me to this day, Outstanding Ingenue. I can actually still remember the clip they played to illustrate your work right before you won. I mean, I was such a big fan and so excited watching from home. But what stands out to you about the experience of winning and the night of that first victory?
All right, I'm looking at the Emmy right now, and it says Outstanding Juvenile Female.
Oh, Outstanding Juvenile Female. Oh, my goodness.
Yes. So thank God I missed the ingenue one.
they did a little polish on that, which I'm extremely grateful.
So what stands out for me? Well, I knew it was a tight category, and I think it was pretty much between like me and Liz Vassy were both nominated that year. And I was really hoping because, again, I you know, if I didn't make these markers, it was sort of just the way I'd set up the game in my head was, you know, this isn't, you're not meant to be this. Because I didn't just want to be okay at something, you know, and I wanted to be really good at something. It's much more fun. So, boy, what do I remember about that? I remember the dress, which I bought in with my mom in Westport, Connecticut, at a store. And you know, my mom loved to buy clothes for me that were really meant for a woman in her 40s in the 50s.
And if I recall correctly, there was quite some shoulder pads going on there as well.
Oh my God. In the jacket. Yes. So I tried to get that jacket off as fast as I possibly could, but like, good grief. I mean, I am just I'm a fashion disaster for most of the nights. It's really horrifying.
Everyone was.
I mean, when I did world turns later on, I just said to the ladies in the hair department, I said, no ice sculptures. No, don't do it. I know you can, but I beg of you not to. So that Emmys was really, really important to me. And winning was huge. And all I wanted to do was tell Michael Knight how much I loved him. It's like, I love you so much. I didn't know what love was. It was just like my partner. And I just that was the feeling I had of like, you know, I love my partner, my friend, my buddy who's been, you know, helping me to achieve these moments in my work. And that I loved David Canary. I had to tell him that I loved him. I had to tell Julia Parr how much I loved her. You know, so that's it. You just get ridiculous when you have those moments. You just want to tell everybody how much you love them. So that's what I did.
Now, Dixie's meddlesome uncle on the show, Palmer Courtland, was played by another legendary actor who is no longer with us, James Mitchell. What comes to your mind when you think about him?
Oh, James was funny. He was funny. I will always like there. Here's a perfect example. So sometimes in the blocking, we would end up sort of standing next to each other, almost shoulder to shoulder in a straight line, so that the cameras, which are, you know, opposite us, they call it like a fourth wall. Like if you imagine in a theater, it's very, very similar of a setup. So the cameras are sort of where the audience would be in a theater. So the cameras can get all of our reactions at the end of the shot, you know, in the older times of soaps, the tags would just kind of go on and on. The end of the tags are the characters reacting to some sort of dramatic moment at the end of a scene. And we had to hold for the tags. So we're standing in a line, holding for tags, looking at each other. And suddenly he starts to say, "Birds on a beach, birds on a beach." And we're like those seagulls looking at each other, you know, with the head craning to the left, to the right. And we died laughing so hard. And I still use that expression anytime, like we're at the end of a scene, I'll be like, "Birds on a beach." Yeah. Was it you? Did you do it? Yeah. So he was funny and classy and, boy, just a never came to work and said like, "Oh, by the way, my years in Hollywood, blah, blah, blah. My years at studios, blah, blah, blah." He was never like that. He was just there. "What are we doing today? Let's run lines." And Michael always tells this story, which I think is funny. Sometimes, you know, sometimes it was hard to remember all those lines. And so he would sometimes take some of his lines, cut them out of the script and tape them onto the back of certain props. So then in the blocking, if he had to walk over to the mantle and there was a plate, decorative plate on the mantle, he'd take the plate off and he would take it off and look at the back of it like he was inspecting the plate, and there would be his line. So he would have it.
Smart.
So one day Mike and someone else, I forget who, but they rearranged all the props. So during shooting, he would walk over and he'd pick up the plate and it was the wrong plate and there wasn't the line. And he was waiting. Yeah. So then he was like, "Michael." Never had a way who did it. But it was good fun. It was all in good fun and, you know, no meanness at all. It was just everyone being silly to each other. So it was good times. Very grateful to have them.
Well, you ended up leaving All My Children for the first time in 1996, then returned from 1998 through 2002. By that time, she had been Mrs. Tad Martin three times over. Now, you last aired as Dixie in February 2002, and in April, just a short time later, you made your As the World Turns debut as Rosanna Cabot. So tell us about how you joining As the World Turns came about.
I mean, I'm sure you know this, but like that was not the last time I played Dixie in 2002.
Yes, so
that was
of course, like, of course.
Yeah, so that was just like the last big chunk, like a giant arc. When I finished that particular arc, you know, the way World Turns kind of came around was because it had a lot to do with the World Trade Center 9/11 happening, and it was such a momentous experience to be in New York when that occurred. I'm sure I wasn't like. I was like many people who said, "Okay, everything in my life now has to change. I'm going to break up with my boyfriend. I'm going to color my hair. I'm going to move. I mean, I'm going to change jobs." I did all of those things, every single one. And then I was like, "Wow, this is, you know, the economy was in the crapper, if you will." And I was like, "Wow, this is not really a great time to be doing all of these things. Maybe I should take my job back." And then World Turns called and I was like, "Okay, this is a nice change. It's a little bit of a change. It's a new character, but it's still in the daytime world. It's still a regular job that'll help me cover my costs for now." And that's kind of exciting. You know, I can show people that I can play something else. And it, you know, it was really just Chris Gautman, the executive producer, calling me up and asking me if I wanted to do it, which was great. We love jobs like that. And so, you know, we just had dinner and talked about it. And, you know, really, I love the character. And again, he was also very open to me developing the character. So I wrote a huge backstory and what she would be like and in various situations and, you know, made suggestions as to, you know, possible options for other history that, you know, may not have occurred with when the character was existing before. And I love to be, you know, it never really occurred to me that that wasn't something that I could do as an actor, you know, because I've been doing it as Dixie. I always created these backstories or, you know, figured out different ways to play the character in a new way through writing. And so that was fantastic. And again, it was a great opportunity to have to prove myself, you know, so I was going to prove myself in a whole new way on that show. And I'm so glad because I met some amazing people, including the amazing, wonderful Maura West, who I adore and respect so much. So, and John, of course, who I'm married to.
Of course.
Yes.
Well, having spent the majority of your adulthood, you know, and career on All My Children, you know, what was it like joining and adjusting to a new show?
Yeah, it was a shock because All My Children was one of those shows where the network was very involved. There were always some kind of, there was like little stardust on it. There were famous actors that would come to the set. And of course, it was right there in the middle of New York City. So there was a little bit more of a spotlight on the show. And World Turns had moved out to the furthest reaches of Brooklyn. And so the network wasn't very involved. They weren't going to really make a big effort to get into their car and drive out to Midwood. It was almost at Coney Island for people who are trying to spot it on the map in their minds. And it was a good, you know, 45 minutes to an hour, depending on where you lived in the city or in Brooklyn. And just to get to work. And the studio was a little grimier. And I think some people there had a bit of a chip on their shoulder about like, we're the real show. We're the real actors, you know, you All My Children, you ABC people, you know. It's just sort of like the New York LA thing, you know, like, we're better. Oh, you guys are, you're shallow. You got your head up your butt, you know, like just people, just the way people do things. It's just funny. So I was like, whoa, hey, you know, I'm here to work really hard. I worked really hard on All My Children. Like that, this was not like tea and cakes every day. This was hard work. So I had to prove myself to them. And that's just, I don't know, just the way it is sometimes. It's not every show welcomes you with open arms. And I think I earned my stripes. And I think that's probably why it took me three times to, you know, I had three nominations in a row for Emmy nominations before I won. Finally, you know, I just had to do my time, you know, as they had done their time and earn my place. So I did.
Well, you mentioned the great good fortune you had to play sisters on As the World Turns with Maura West. One of the real like through line relationships for Rosanna was the Carly Rosanna one. So we'd love to hear more about your relationship with Maura and what it was like to work with her and play sisters with her.
Well, Maura is also hilarious. One of the hardest workers I've ever met. She used to commute in. Sometimes it would be 2 hours each way because she had a bunch of kids and she wanted them to live in, you know, away from the city. They didn't want to raise their kids in the city. So I was like, I don't know how you do that. I couldn't do that. I tried that and I was like, no, that's not, no, no. No, not happening. So that lasted for like a month. So yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that I remember the most, and she might remember this as well too, is I had, you know, World Turns was like her first big break, you know, and I had had a break before that for a very long period of time. And I had also had all these experiences before I got All My Children on tons of different sets and tons of different scenarios. So I had a very sisterly feeling towards her when she got tired or she needed some extra just shoulder to lean on. And I was happy to be that for her because I knew how she felt. I knew how it felt to burn out. I knew how it felt to have a tough day. I knew how it felt to want to have an ally on set with you, because sometimes this sets can be very competitive, and it's not my favorite kind of acting. I don't like it, but I can't always control it if somebody wants to compete with me. Acting wise, you know, there's actually a whole mode of thinking in terms of acting training that the whole scene is a competition, which I personally hate. But some people do that and train that. And I think it's an anathema to the craft itself, but that's just me. So I was really, it was just like, I remember a very particular moment where we had, where she realized that I wasn't there to compete with her. And it was, she could relax. And I was so grateful to be able to give that to her. You know, I was like, oh, I'm so happy to help you see that not everybody in this business is a shark, you know?
Well, that show also proved to be successful for you Emmy-wise. In 2004, you picked up your second Emmy, this one for Outstanding Supporting Actress for the role of Rosanna. What are your memories of that second win?
I went with my my best friend, Rhonda, and we sat in the front row, and she sat, I remember her nudging me and going, oh my God, we're sitting next to Ellen. Which was so great. And it was just, it was really, really a good night. And what's crazy is, I shouldn't say who it was, but someone who was very drunk. I put the Emmy down afterwards. And he walked through our circle and he tripped over my Emmy and broke it.
Oh, wow.
Yes, he broke it. He broke the wing off. And like that sound you made was like everybody in the group went, oh. And I was like, oh, so far for the course of life. But I just, I like went home and I taped it, you know.
Oh, no.
Some scotch tape. And I was like, that's not going to work, is it? So they sent me a new one. Bless them. They sent me a new one. Oh, but that was so bizarre. I was like, broken Emmy. I should write a poem. Broken Emmy. All that work and this is broken. But, you know, it's one of those moments like I've had many in life, which tell you, like, don't hang on to these things too hard. You know, it's just a moment. It's just a little check mark, you know, that you get to have for a minute. But there are more important things than this. So enjoy it, you know, enjoy life, but you know, don't hang your hat on it. It doesn't make you better than anybody else, you know. Maybe I have that Midwesternness, you know, my mom was Midwestern and upbringing anyway. And, you know, they tell you don't get too big for your britches.
Yeah. Well, Rosanna had a tortured relationship, I think it is fair to say, with the character of Paul Ryan, who was played by Roger Howarth. What was working with Roger like?
Roger is a really good actor, and he's a very odd duck. And I could never tell whether he liked me or not. I was pretty sure that he didn't. but I kept trying to make him like me, which just, you know how that is. That never goes well. But we worked really well together. We played off each other really well. And somehow or other, our characters worked really well together. So when we were acting, there was this very tangible energy that, you know, some people call chemistry or magic. And then, you know, call cut and that is gone. That was just gone. It was just turned on and it would turn off. It was a strange experience. You know, as time's gone by, I've really grown in my respect for Roger. I've always respected him, but I've really grown in my respect. And watching him work with John on General Hospital, he's done some really, really incredible work. And I think he deserves a little more recognition as an actor. I really do.
Mm-hmm. Now, for a good period of time, you sort of went back and forth between All My Children and World Turns, and certainly your most infamous exit from All My Children occurred when Dixie was seemingly killed off via a batch of poisoned pancakes. Now, in the end, Dixie came back to life and sometime later got a happy ending. But at the time, no pun intended, I imagine that left a bad taste in your mouth.
you know, that year could have been a lot of things, but it turned out to be one of the hardest years of my life, I think. Partly because, well, there were a lot of reasons, but that I made the mistake of saying what I wanted. You know, I mean, sometimes with a show, you've got to smell the atmosphere and you've really got to consider the politics and see what is happening. And at that time, I was just, you know, it's taken me a lifetime to learn this, but but I did not recognize that there was a much heavier network influence at that time that was playing into the politics behind the scenes. And so when I was taken to lunch and asked, well, what kind of stuff, what stories do you like, Katie? And I was like, oh, you're asking me? Well, instead of saying what I should have said, which is like, whatever she wants to write, I'm sure is going to be great. I said, well, I like social justice storylines. And I really love, like, you know, anything that had to do with what Agnes was doing back in the 80s with like AIDS and homelessness and, you know, and I just watched that writer who shall not be named just look at me like she wanted to kill me because she had a story all written. And it just didn't enter my little pea brain that I was making that story go away by what I was saying. And I didn't realize I even had that power at that time. I had no idea. So, so that became a very difficult year because I think she was very angry at me for ruining this great story idea that she had. And I got the brunt of that. And I've talked about that before. And, you know, I don't think it was right or fair personally to take your anger out on an actor, but I have seen it done before. And if somebody doesn't like you and they have to write for you, you know, I really, you know, that's going to be a tough year for you. And it was for me. I mean, I literally had to do I want to kill myself story for 3 months straight. And you going to work and doing monologues about how much you want to die is really hard on you personally. We play our field is the field of emotion. And, you know, you can't help when you're doing a very difficult storyline every day to take some of that home with you. And after about 3 months, I began to get angry, as anybody would when they're being forced to do something that's really painful and almost felt like torture. So so that was just, you know, and then that's not a good feeling. And, you know, and you get, you know, snarky and bitchy and angry yourself. And it, then I had an epiphany, which was like, you know, Katie, just let it go. Just let it go. And just, you're there to do a job. Just shut up, go do your job and entertain people and just don't let this get to you. And by the time I'd made that turn, I think, you know, I'd had a conversation with that writer and that did not sit well with her. And I wasn't like I was an a-hole, if you will. I mean, I was saying, you know, could you please? And, you know, if you would please consider, you know, I was respectful and polite. But I wasn't towing the line, which is sometimes just what you have to do in a job like soaps where, you know, they're writing a script every day, 5 days a week, you know, at least, you know, 360 weeks a year. So a few weeks off, but it's an enormous undertaking for writers. And, So by the time I kind of had my epiphany, she had made up her mind and Poison Pancakes was going to be my her final word on the subject, which is I've had to live with ever since in terms of conversations about it, you know? And I'm like, okay, well, let's just call it what it is, you know? Just, I don't, do you ever see Soap Dish? Do you ever see the movie Soap Dish?
Yes, of course.
Right, so... You know, I always think when I talk about this storyline, I think about Whoopi Goldberg saying, he's got no head. How can he come back to the show if he's got no head? And so it just felt like that. And so, you know, but fortunately, you know, that was, I remember saying, you know, it hasn't affected me horribly, but it has definitely affected me to some degree. But I remember sitting with the producer who was telling me that they were going to kill my character. And she said to me, you know, we almost didn't do this. And I was like, well, then why? Why
right.
Just don't do it. But she had spotted when I'd made the turn. She had spotted when I made the turn in my own approach. And they said, you know, we saw you at the Disney event down in Disney Orlando, or wherever that was. And, you know, you just seemed to really be happy. And I was like, I guess I made that turn a little too late. But so the story goes.
Darn you, Satin Slayer.
I mean, it's so, you know, I mean, Mike will say this too. I'm sorry, Mike, I'm bringing you into this. But the show didn't feel quite like the old All My Children, you know, at that point either. And I know the next year there was a new writer that came on, and he was giving people notes like, if you don't understand what's happening with the characters or what's happening in the moment, just look as an actor, just look like you smell something bad.
Okay. Wow.
And I was like, that would not have sat well with me, because I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, wow. Because that's somebody who thinks of the actors as like, we're just Barbies, and you know, and we're not really actors. We're, you know, we're just Barbie dolls. That was probably the case, you know, very contemptuous of the actual acting, you know. But I'll tell you, the shows that are still on, those actors are working their butt off to try to be, you know, give you great performances, give you real performances. And I think that's oftentimes overlooked when people talk about the medium. You know, if you stop and you sit and you watch a great scene and you're like, that's great acting, you know, I could be on this show, could be on any show, you know.
And achieved under, you know, much, much harder conditions and circumstances.
Exactly.
So,
yeah, yes,
no,
exactly.
I agree with you.
Yeah.
So, you know, you sort of spent the early aughts, going back and forth between both All My Children and As the World Turns. And then at the end of the decade, you were part of both of their finales, first of World Turns in 2010, and then the following year, All My Children. What stands out to you about your last day at World Turns?
You know, I had left the show a couple of times, so I had not quite the same kind of level of attachment that the people who were there had been there consistently for years, like, you know, Maura and Michael Park. And so I remember just really feeling for them, you know, because it was them going into the great unknown, and also just a huge end of an era for them. And I've been through like those huge moments myself, you know, in different ways. And, you know, like I said, like I just thought, wow, this is, you know, this is tough. And I was friends with some of the producers as well. And so, you know, even after they stopped shooting, you know, we were talking, how's it going? As they were closing up the sets and the studio. And she said, you know, it would be fine if I didn't have to hear the sound of the sets going through the wood chipper all day.
Mm. Wow.
You know? And I was like, whoa, that's so sad. You know, just like all that. Cause you know, I mean, just as we're saying, like this huge world, no pun intended, but you know, that takes so many people to build and then continue and keep going, you know, was now considered no longer, you know, needed or wanted. And I mean, my God, how many years was that show on the air? Like 40?
It
was
1956 to 2010.
I mean, that's 54 years.
My math's worse, so I'm going to take your word for 54 years.
But it feels like, you know, I mean, there's nothing like that to be closing that show out. And then, you know, the horrible feeling like, oh, it's our fault. Like we weren't good enough. We weren't we didn't try hard enough. So, feeling like you're letting down the legacy, you know? So there was a lot of that feeling. And then with All My Children, you know, very similar feeling of like, we've let down the legacy. And yet there was this sprinkle of hope with the online contract kind of hanging in the air. And and a feeling like, you know, I mean, everybody said in the 90s when the OJ trial was being, was preempting all of our shows, like, oh my God, you know, this ride's going to end. This is going to end. This is, daytime is about to lose its place in terms of how it dominates the ratings and supports nighttime television with the money that it gets from the sponsors. And, you know, it was so I think people had been prepping for years, like, this situation is going to change. And the concept of moving it to the internet, it really was a brilliant concept. It was just poor execution. And, you know, wasn't the execution of artistically, because they brought back the show. There was the show. There was the feeling, the home, the energy of All My Children. And Ginger Smith was the EP, and she did that so beautifully. And she'd been with All My Children for a really, really long time. I mean, since back in the 80s. So she knew the show. But somehow or other, the financial side of things just weren't handled, you know, properly. They didn't keep the reins on the horses. And that was really too bad. It was not just for us, but for the fans, because I think the fans were really ready to make that jump, you know?
Absolutely. And Mara and I have always talked about how it was like a little ahead of its time in terms of streaming.
Yeah.
And perhaps if it was done now, I feel like we would be looking at a completely different circumstance and success rate.
Right. Totally. Totally. I think now, you know, last year or now, COVID and all that, but like COVID notwithstanding, yes, now it would be a big hit. It would be a big hit.
I couldn't agree more. Well, you did make your way back to daytime in 2014. You pop back up as Kelly on Young and the Restless. So she's probably best remembered for torturing her ex-lover, Jack, played by Peter Bergman. Did you have fun working with Peter?
You know what? The big hoot was that Peter and I had crossed paths on All My Children back in 88, you know, and he loved that show so much that his wife saved a brick from the building when it was torn down.
he got choked up telling us that story on the podcast. So did Mara and me.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's how much he loved the show. And I was like, wow, dude, I thought I loved the show, but you kind of like went to like a whole new level. And so he, you know, we had that, those fond memories and nostalgia in common. So that was a pleasure. And also a certain kind of pacing and tone that we understood, and comedy, like romantic comedy, daytime style, which is a very particular thing. And was a pleasure to play. It was a real pleasure to play. I did not like it when they turned the character into a crazy person. That was very painful. And I felt that she wasn't meant to be that. She was meant to be troubled, but she wasn't meant to like fully turn into a psychopath. And, you know, every day I had to do that was painful, but I did my job. I did it. I was going to shut my mouth and do my job, and I did.
You did it. You did it.
Yep.
Goodness. Well, Katie, your daytime characters haven't always been so lucky in love, but a few months ago, you hit the 6-year mark in your real life marriage to John Lindstrom, Kevin and Ryan on General Hospital, who, as you noted, you met on As the World Turns. Do you remember the first time you met John?
Yes, I do, actually. We met in 2001 at the All My Children studios when he was there to direct. And we both looked at each other and went, oh boy, who are you? and we started talking, and then Fanola, who was working on the show then, like interrupted us and like came between us. And then she's like, oh, John, I have to talk to you, because she knew from General Hospital from the West Coast. And I remember looking over to Julia Barr, and she was looking at me like, mm-hmm, yep, he's a cutie. You know, that could work. She was like, that could, you know, giving me that, like, go do that. And I was like, well, you know, I don't know. So that was the first time I met him, and then I didn't see him again until 2009, when I came back to World Turns. And then I was like, do I know you? And he was like walking up the hallway. He's a big guy, you know, walking fast. And I was like, you're from the West Coast, aren't you? And he's from Oregon. And then we just became really good friends. We were really good friends for over a year, and I think. And I remember you know, saying like, gosh, why can't I meet somebody like John? And I was like, well, you met him. So you should say something. So I did. And the rest is history. And we've been together 10 years.
Awesome.
Well, tell us the best thing about being married to John Lindstrom.
John is just one of the best people on the planet, frankly. I mean, he's a good-hearted person. He's a very smart person, incredibly well-informed, well-read. He's kind, deeply kind human being. He's a hard worker. I deeply respect him in terms of his how he deals with people, how he manages his career. He's got a great attitude in his approach to life and just disciplined in his regular everyday life. Like, you know, he just went off on a bike ride and I'm like, I haven't exercised since 1962, you know? So I'm like, God bless you, man. Like, I gotta get into this. I don't know how you do it. He's just the greatest person to live with. I mean, I am so blessed. I'm so blessed in my partner.
That makes us very happy to hear.
Yeah.
Now, for the last several years, you know, you've really been focusing your artistic energy more and more behind the cameras. Indeed, you're an award-winning filmmaker. You're perhaps best known on that side of the camera for your celebrated documentary, Seeing is Believing, Women Direct. You're also a Daytime Emmy-nominated director for your work on the web series Venice. Just recently, your short film on foster girls, which is called Burnt Feathers, Broken Wings, won the Best Social Justice Film Award at the Santa Fe Film Festival. It's a very impressive career pivot, if you will. So tell us about this, you know, sort of professional metamorphosis that you've undergone.
Well, thank you so much for pointing out all those lovely things that I'm so very proud of. I think
you should be.
I am. I think it kind of started, well, I will say, all the way back in my early 20s, I took a directing workshop in New York at Ensemble Studio Theater with Kurt Dempster. And I decided then I wanted to be a director. And I went to my mom and I told her, and she said, oh, God, please don't. I didn't know what she meant or what she was talking about, but she was like, you have to promise me that you're not going to do that. And she was dying. She was very sick, and she died when I was 25. It's okay. It's been 25 years, right? So at the time I was supporting her. And so I was like, okay, I guess, you know, this is very depressing, but I guess I won't. And I just put it out of my head. But all the time I was on All My Children, because I started that show so young, I had it in the back of my head. Like, well, there'll be something else that I will grow into doing. And I thought it was going to be painting. So I went to art school in my late 20s. When I went back to All My Children, I was paying for art school. And then I switched. I was going to start do writing. And when I went to World Turns, I was paying for NYU and then the New School. And I just kept trying to educate myself because I didn't want to find myself without a job and without another vocation. So, because, you know, acting is so, it's not exactly a job that you can count on. And soaps is the only, was, and certainly for a few still is, one of the only consistent jobs there is. So I knew I had to keep studying other aspects of the form. And I was also very lucky to be in New York so that I could go and to see all of these great international films at the various independent cinemas that were all over New York at that time, or Kim's Video. I was telling a friend recently, you know, I didn't get a degree. I went to the movies. I learned so much there. So much. I could go off on that just in its own subject, but you know, the problem with this algorithm in terms of the streaming apps is you only see what they think you want to see. You don't have this opportunity to randomly walk through a video store and suddenly be you know, drawn to a film for, you know, its cover or its title or and then pick it up and read about it and go like, I don't know, this seems really interesting. I might not have ever picked this up before, but I'm going to get this one. So that sort of thing I had a great exposure to in New York, and it really showed me things that were possible in life that I didn't know about before, that I didn't know that these things existed. So that was a little cracking of the door opening. And then in 2008, well, let's say 2006. So the one great thing that did happen in 2006 was I made this album. So I've always done these other arts on the side of daytime. And, you know, the album was an incredible experience. And we worked in great studios in New York. And I was very proud of having made that, and very proud of it still. And when 2008 came around and the financial crisis, I was like, writing, I can write, let me write. And that's when I started writing my book. And that took about 5 years. And so I finished the book and I released that when, it took more than 5 years, but I released that when I started on Young and the Restless. And so, you know, all of this is sort of a preamble, a long preamble. Thank you for listening. to getting behind the camera as a filmmaker. And, you know, one of the things that people underestimate about film is that how much it is an amalgam of all the arts, the visual arts, you know, the music, writing, acting, production design, you know, all camera work, framing, all of these things are arts in and of themselves that all come together in the art of film and the theater. But, you know, film has its own particular way of doing it. And so I think, gosh, when was it? It was 2011 when I was doing the online version of All My Children. And I was going to have somebody else direct the short, that film that I had written. And John said, well, why don't you direct it? And suddenly the spark was like, gosh, I guess I could. And I had been helping him with his feature film at that time, you know, and various projects. And I'd written a pilot and, dabbling really, but just sort of, you know, flexing and seeing what it was, what I could do and what I like to do. And when I started making that first short film, it was called Flip Fantasia. It was just so much fun because, you know, it was every single art, and I got to play in every single world of that art. And wow, that is fun. As a director, that is a lot of fun. So I did a second film right away called The World of Albert Pho. And within 4 months, I was like, boom, let's make another one. Again, it's brutally hard work, but if you like that, if you're a marathon runner, this is a job you will like. If you're a creative marathon runner. And so I just was like, okay, I remembered I wanted to direct. I was like, yes, I will do this. And then the statistics all started coming out in the news about how few women were getting hired and getting being able to make actual careers as directors. And I was like, no, no, I just found it. No. So I fell into this idea of, well, you can be part of the solution or you can be part of the problem, but you can't just stand around and complain about it. That's not going to work. So I said, okay, what can I do? And the idea came, you know, make a documentary. And that's the craziest thing for anyone to decide that they're going to do. Let me tell you, like, if you've never made a documentary before and you've never even made a short form documentary before, it takes a lot of just pure, I don't know, like naive guts, which I guess I had. John was looking at me like, oh my God, you're not. Because a documentary is like, it's like a narrative on steroids. You know, you're making a movie without knowing what the movie is going to be. There's not like a pre-written script that you can even follow. You don't know what people are going to say. And you just get this rough idea. I think I'll have some animation. I'll talk to all these people. And well, then we'll go and shoot some B-roll. And then maybe I can get on some sets and get some B-roll. And then you got to put the whole thing together. And oh my God, it was like jumping into grad school without going to undergrad. So I'm glad I did it, but you know, if I was fat at the Emmys, there's a reason why. Because I was stress eating some cookies. I was like, I'm editing, leave me alone and bring me the peanut butter. You know? Oh my God. I was like, what do you mean it's the Emmys? I was like, I can't put that dress on. So, oh girl, it's a cross your leg situation and hope for the silhouette. But I learned it. Thank God I learned it. I also had this idea that, oh, I'm going to shoot other things while I'm making this, so I really understand the craft of directing and I'm not just making a movie about something I don't know enough about. Brilliant. So I shot another short film, and then I shot Venice the series, season 5, but we had it split into two periods of time. And so we got the two noms for that, which was great. But, it was setting the bar really high. Crazy. But also great. You know, I guess it's sort of like full circle. Like, you know, you put yourself in the hot water and you either learn how to swim or you drown. And if you learn how to swim, you can swim really good. And so, swim really well. And so I'm really grateful that I chose to do that, because now I have all these tools and all these understandings about the world of filmmaking and about women in filmmaking. And I'm, again, like, super grateful that the film has made people feel like they can go out and do it. And that is the great win for me for all that effort and all of that exhaustion and all those pounds is that I've had women come up to me crying who are like, I was giving up on my career. I was giving up on myself. I didn't think that I could do this. And watching this movie made me realize that it's not only that I can, but that it's important for me to do this. My voice is important. And I was like, yes, win. So that's been a great joy of the documentary, and it's continuing to have a life. Like, I got a film sales agent. We're getting calls internationally. We're getting calls from PBS now, which is great. And you know, it's just it's going to be a long journey, and I'm very excited about that. Very excited. And I could talk forever too about Kids in the Spotlight and working with those foster kids, which is another great joy of my life, making films with foster kids. And that particular documentary that won the award at the Santa Fe Film Festival is about foster girls struggling with addiction. And I'm so proud to say that one of the girls is now enrolled in a film screenwriting program. And I'm like, yes!
Wow, that's amazing.
Isn't that great?
Yes, great. It really is.
Yeah. Well, before we let you go, is there anything you would like to say to those listeners who have been likely a fan of yours since 1988 and have followed your life and career ever since?
Well, I'm so grateful that those fans still follow me, whether I'm doing crazy videos like Susie Effing Homemaker and, you know, being just bananas and having a good time, and they're loving that, and, you know, or loving the nostalgia and the old pictures on social that I've been posting, that I've been finding during COVID. It's all been this like deep dive into the boxes, you know, what's in here? And so much fun to share that. And I'm so happy they've come along for the ride on the films. And, you know, one of the things that has always inspired me as an actor has been the lives of the people who watch the show. So their lives, their suffering, their joys, their family, their losses, their wins, like their humanity is what makes me want to do what I do. So without them, I wouldn't have that inspiration. Like, they are my inspiration, and they are the reason I make these movies. I make them for them. And so I'm so grateful that they've supported my work, whether I'm acting or filmmaking. I just so grateful that they were part of this my circle, and I hope they'll stay with me forever.
I'm sure they will. Well, it was so nice catching up with you and hearing all your wonderful stories. Send our best to John, and once again, just thanks for being with us today.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you so much for asking. I'm just so honored that Soap Opera Digest is doing these interviews and that I was included. Thank you so much for reaching out.
So glad we did. Thank you, Katie.
Okay.
Well, have a wonderful day. We'll talk soon.
Okay, sounds great.
Okay.
Bye.
Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you to Katie McLean for being our guest. If you like this podcast, please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Be sure to pick up a new issue on sale now and come back next week for another podcast.
One, two, three, four. Those are numbers. But you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.